Hello, listeners, and welcome to Ohio Mysteries. We are taking a step into true crime tonight, but first, make sure you check out last Sunday's episode. If you want to know what the naming of Cincinnati has to do with George Washington, definitely check it out. Now, Paul and I wanted to thank you all for your continued support. We still get people who come up to us and say, "You're the host of Ohio Mysteries, right?" We are proud that we have so many fans out there, but we always love to keep growing. The best way you could do that for us is to tell a friend or family member about us. Share an episode with them. Leave us a great review. Now, let's throw another log on the fire, campers. Let's dig up a new Ohio mystery. I'm your co-host, Steve Yoder, and with us, as always, is our award-winning journalist who spent 30-plus years with the Akron Beacon Journal telling stories just like this one, Paula Schleiss.
Hi, everybody. Seems like it's been a while since we did a true crime episode, so we are overdue. Lord knows Ohio has more cold cases than we could ever get to, but we are going to keep plugging away. Steve and I feel a responsibility and a privilege to make sure these victims aren't forgotten. Tonight, we've got the story of Peter J. Betchy Jr., a 35-year-old New Jersey native, a father, husband, biochemist, and business executive, assassinated in the basement of his home in 1987. Betchy is the only unsolved homicide on the books of the Shawnee Township Police Department. That's a suburb of Lima in northwest Ohio's Allen County, at that time with a population of about 15,000. So let's get started, and let me tell you a little bit about Peter. Peter was born in 1951 to Eileen and Peter Betchy Sr. He was the big brother to two sisters and two younger brothers. His mom worked in an office. His dad was a carpenter. You can imagine their pride as Peter grew up to become a scientist and collect a PhD in biochemistry from the University of Maryland. By 1974, Peter was living in upstate New York with his wife, Joyce. The pair were high school sweethearts and stayed together through all his years in school. If you saw a picture of Peter, you'd say, "That's a science nerd." He looked every bit his chosen career, an average build at 5'10 and 180 pounds, glasses over his brown eyes, his brown hair cut short. Peter and Joyce settled into family life, adding two children, another Peter, like he and his father before him, and a daughter, Jennifer. And Peter landed a job with the Food and Drug Administration at a testing facility in Waverly, New York. He may have been in charge of that facility. I found ads in local papers with him seeking to hire employees that had experience handling laboratory animals. More than a decade into married life, Peter was offered a new job opportunity to become president of the Springborn Institute for Biological Research in Spencerville. That's a small rural community west of Lima, Ohio. This was nearly 40 years ago, and the only references I can find to that institute on the internet are related to Peter's murder, and news stories back then never explained exactly what they did. Whatever it was an opportunity Peter didn't want to pass on. His wife, however, was less excited about the move, but she followed Peter to Ohio in 1985. The family settled in Shawnee Township in a sandstone and wood tri-level home on Kiowa Trail in the affluent and picturesque community of Indian Brook. Peter was ambitious and undeniably a workaholic, but saw the move as a chance to make more time for his kids. They spent their weekends rafting and fishing. But Joyce was never happy about the change, and she only grew more restless. She had supported Peter through his long march to get that PhD, and now she wanted her turn, something for herself beyond her role as wife and mother. 18 months into their Ohio relocation, Joyce Betchy left her family. She said she wanted to go to school and move to Kent, a 3-hour drive from Lima. But she never enrolled at Kent State University. And it's unclear if Peter knew his wife wasn't actually a student. She moved into a place owned by a college student named Eugene Schuma. Eugene was 22 years old. Joyce was in her late 30s. And both would later deny their relationship was romantic. Joyce supported herself with a new job she got at the Limited Clothing Store. Meanwhile, back in Shawnee Township, the Betchy children, now 10 and 5 years old, were being cared for by Peter with the help of a babysitter. Joyce would occasionally pick them up on weekends, sometimes with her new male friend. The kids came to call him Uncle Eugene. Peter met Eugene as well, and they even got friendly, at one point talking about going into a real estate venture together. In the first weeks of 1987, Joyce left Ohio for a time to stay with her father in Florida. But then she moved back to Ohio. Some stories said she actually moved back in with Peter and the kids. But even if that were the case, the clock was already ticking on the time they'd have together as a family. The evening of Friday, February the 6th, 1987, about 6 p.m., Peter came home from work. An hour later, Joyce told Peter she was taking the kids to go shopping for a Valentine's Day present for him. As they pulled away from the house, Peter went to the basement to work out with his gym equipment. Joyce and the kids didn't go shopping. Instead, they met Eugene at a restaurant in Lima called China Gate. And Eugene wasn't alone. He'd brought a puppy, told the kids he'd rescued it, and it was for them. After dinner, the foursome went to a local Baskins and Robbins for ice cream. Joyce drove her Camaro, the kids playing with a puppy in the back seat. Eugene followed in his car. After finishing their treats, Eugene hopped on the interstate for the long ride home to Kent, and Joyce and the kids went back to the house on Kiowa Trail.
In 2009, in Cleveland, Ohio, Don Pasella was hired by federal and state prosecutors to serve as office manager for a multi-jurisdictional mortgage fraud task force.
This was Don's dream job. As a fierce advocate for justice, she wanted to be a part of something bigger and make a difference in the world.
We are working together to aggressively investigate and prosecute mortgage fraud throughout Northeast Ohio.
Dawn's dream job quickly turned into a nightmare.
She realized that things weren't as they seemed. Evidence was missing, the chain of custody was broken, and her signature was falsified.
Ultimately, Dawn was forced to wear a wire to spy on defendant Tony Viola. When she refused, she was threatened by her bosses.
After Dawn did not appear in court to testify to the misconduct, she was found dead in her apartment under suspicious circumstances. But her death was never properly investigated.
The Parma Police Department closed the case after ruling her death a simple alcohol overdose.
We think there's more to this story.
It's never too late to uncover the truth.
I'm Lexi Kakis.
I'm Andrea Cipriano.
I'm Dana Pohl.
And this is Seeking Justice.
It was about 10 p.m. when Joyce and the kids pulled into the driveway. Years later, the son, 10 years old at the time, would mention that it was odd that their mother led them to the front door, since they always entered the house from the garage. Joyce went in first, immediately calling out for Peter. When Peter didn't call back, Joyce moved further into the house, turned a corner, and found him, face down at the top of the basement stairs. She screamed. The kids were a few steps behind her. She yelled at them to stop, then rushed them out of the house. They all ran to the neighbors. When police responded to the scene, they half expected to find Peter had died of cardiac arrest, and he did have a faint pulse at first. But it didn't take long to see they were standing in a crime scene. A trail of blood led them into the basement and the area where Peter had been working with free weights. Scattered around the floor, they found four shell casings from a .45 caliber gun. Peter had been shot four times. They were all through and through. One in the collarbone, one in his chest, one in his face, and a final one in the back of his head, execution style. The basement had only one way in and one way out, so one can only imagine what must have happened for Peter to have been attacked in one corner of the basement and his frantic effort to escape up the stairs. Then that final bullet through the head as he lay bleeding at the end of his journey. Neighbors said they never heard the gunshots. The basement likely muted the sound. A private funeral service was held in Ohio for Peter. Then his remains were returned to his hometown in New Jersey for burial. A month later, the Lima News carried an ad for a public auction of the Becci House's belongings. The long listing included things like a king-size brass bed, an Ethan Allen Davenport and matching love seat, a dining room suite, rocking chair, stereo equipment, leather recliner, bookcases, lamps, landscaping equipment. Police, meanwhile, were making very little progress on the case. The Becci family put up a $5,000 reward, then increased it to $25,000. They made repeated visits from New Jersey to Ohio to visit with police, mostly to encourage them to keep looking for their son's killer. A national TV program, Current Affair, aired a report in the hopes of generating tips. But the case went cold. A little more than a year later, the Shawnee Township Police Department abolished its only detective's position and announced the investigation into the Becci murder had been suspended. The case remained buried in a filing cabinet for years. Then, about a decade ago, a Shawnee detective named Don Merrick, who had just left the Lima police to take the job, was intrigued by the case. It was the only unsolved murder in the township, so it was of natural interest to him. He started interviewing everyone he could find, and he and Peter's family even put up two billboards in Lima to remind people of the murder and try to stir up some memories from 15 years earlier. Merrick talked about his efforts with a now-defunct podcast called The Murder Squad. He said one thing the police focused on was a motive. It did not appear to be a robbery. Peter's Rolex and billfold were found on the kitchen table. There were no signs of a struggle or break-in, no disarray in the house as if someone was looking for something. It seemed clear to investigators the killer had one mission, to kill Peter. And yet, they didn't think the killer was a professional. It took four shots to kill Peter, and the kind of gun used was noisy and not likely a preference for someone skilled at such things. So what then? Could his work at a bio-research company have attracted some sort of enemy? They did animal testing, and that's a pretty passionate topic. But there was no indication Peter had been threatened. Interviews with friends, family, and co-workers also ruled out things like gambling debt, drinking, or drug use. So without anything pointing outward, police looked inward. Obviously, a disruptive marriage and an extra man in the wings are motivations as old as time. Police did attempt to make a case, either against Joyce Betche or Eugene Shuma, though it's not clear. In late 1987, they took their evidence to a grand jury, which means they thought they might have enough to build a case. But grand juries are secret, and we don't know who the target was or what kind of evidence they had. As a matter of fact, we don't know anything officially because the grand jury failed to indict, and at some point, the file from that procedure was thrown away. Apparently, the county does not keep old grand jury files unless they result in a trial. One thing we do know is that Eugene Shuma was called to give testimony, and from his own acknowledgement, he pled the fifth, the legal out given to people who fear that speaking will incriminate themselves. A few years ago, as Detective Merrick reopened the case and tried to recreate the investigation, he talked to several family members, including Peter and Joyce's now-grown son, Peter. The man, who was 10 at the time of the murder, remembered vividly the events of that night after arriving home, walking into the house through the front door when they usually enter the garage, his mother's screams, how he and his sister were raced to the neighbor's house. He remembered the ambulances and paramedics and spending most of the night in the neighbor's bedroom, away from the action. The events of that night before coming home were more fuzzy, he said. He remembered having ice cream, and he remembered the dog, though he couldn't remember what happened to the dog. But the person who detectives really wanted to talk to was Joyce Betche. She had said very little to police in the days after her husband was murdered. At one point, Joyce offered to talk if authorities granted her immunity, but that request was turned down. Joyce Betche moved to Florida 3 days after her husband's death. Shawnee and Allen County investigators made some trips to Florida, New York, and New Jersey in their initial investigation, but eventually they announced it was costing the department and the county too much money, and they couldn't afford to do more. So when Detective Merrick reopened the case in 2012, he and Detective Jack Miller flew to Florida to once again seek an interview with Joyce, who was living in the West Palm Springs area. The detectives rented a car and drove to Joyce's home. She answered the door, but said she wasn't feeling well. They agreed to come back the next day. But the next day, she wouldn't answer the door. So the detectives sat in their rental car in her driveway, talking to her on the speakerphone. She said she had no answers for them. She kept saying she had medical problems that had caused memory loss. The more they asked, the more she deflected. Frustrated, Detective Merrick asked her one final question. What part did you play in your husband's murder? Joyce Betche hung up. One thing, police said, remains a mystery, relates to Peter's life insurance policy. It was worth $500,000, more than $1 million in today's dollars. The policy originally was written to be divided in thirds between Peter's wife and his two children. Later, it was rewritten to go entirely to Joyce, but that change didn't take effect until March the 1st. Peter was murdered about 3 weeks before then. Police couldn't help but wonder if Joyce didn't know that the new policy terms weren't yet in effect. Peter Becci's brother, Mike, who was 8 years younger, said the murder was something his parents dealt with daily until their deaths. He told the Lima News in 2016, "It kind of takes a piece of you. You learn how to live with it, but you never learn to get over it." In 1989, that was just 2 years after the murder, his parents, Peter and Eileen, put their Hillsdale, New Jersey home up for sale. They told a local newspaper they needed the money from selling the house to hire a private investigator because Ohio authorities had told them they were done. A Shawnee Township trustee, Wendell Bauscher, was quoted saying, "There is only so much money that you can lay out for different things." Shawnee police were not happy with that decision at all. One investigator told the newspaper that he was sure the money would have been found if the victim were a well-known resident. That story went on to say that the Allen County Prosecutor's Office was also approached to spend more money on the case, but that they said they wouldn't, and that the family contacted the Ohio Attorney General's office and were told that office had no authority to intervene in criminal matters. Believe it or not, having to sell their home to try and hire a private investigator probably wasn't even the hardest thing faced by Peter and Eileen Becci in the aftermath of their son's death. Mike Becci said his parents only got to see their grandchildren once or twice more after the killing, then never again. Detective Merrick said he doesn't think the case is too old to be solved. He said the department just needs a good lead. If you have that lead, call the Shawnee Police Department at 419-227-1115.
That's it for tonight, listeners. For photos, news clippings, and more on this and every episode, hop on over to OhioMysteries.com. And we will see you here next week for another episode of Ohio Mysteries.
Hello. This is Gary Chachot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.